listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This weekend, the Group of 20 Nations, or G20, will descend upon the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires, for its annual summit. We go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, to discuss what this could mean for Argentina and the Latin America Caribbean region in general.
The G20 starts on, I think it's on November the 30th, the end of this week.
Right, Friday.
And it runs over the weekend, December the 1st. And although Argentina and its government have been projecting it as a summit that will enable the Latin American region. They don't even mention the Caribbean. So they talk about Latin America being able to project itself via this G20 meeting in Buenos Aires. But and the utter insincerity of that is absolutely clear from the fact that they were the ones who scheduled the date. And right. They scheduled it on a day that Mexico is handing over its presidency. So
yeah.
Mexico, who's a member of the G20, will not be represented at the highest level. Mm. So that shows you how sincere Argentina is about projecting Latin America.
And it's a major difference. You know, this handover is a change in direction, you know, chosen by the electorate of Mexico for Mexico.
Yeah, of course.
You know, for Mexico.
And I don't know if Argentina fixed the date after the election result. I suspect that they must have, because it's just inconceivable that any sincere, well-meaning, well-intentioned host of such an important meeting of some of the world's most important economies would schedule it in a way that left out kind of the second most important economy in Latin America, which is Mexico.
Well, it's exactly a year to the day after Argentina assumed the presidency, when Macri assumed it. It was November 30th, 2017, at Kirchner Center in Buenos Aires.
Right. So anyway, however that may be, and the fact is Mexico isn't going to be there. So right. It's absurd for Argentina, or not at the highest level. I mean, obviously they'll have some representation, but it won't be a representation that carries the importance of the Mexican president, whether it's a right wing or a left wing president. Right. In this case, the importance of having the Mexican president would be that they would. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the new Mexican president, however progressive he may be, and he's definitely going to be more progressive and more nationalist in his policies than Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president. But he's definitely not somebody who naturally feels at home projecting neoliberal ideas, and he got elected on the basis that he'd change Mexico in a way that reflects the needs and aspirations of people at grassroots, and that was essentially his appeal, and that's why he and his Moreno movement had such a categorical win during those elections, which included not just the presidential elections, but also the legislative elections, and his Moreno party got a significant majority in Mexico's parliament. Now, we'll just have to see how things progress in Mexico's internal affairs, and whether Andrés Manuel López Obrador can maintain some momentum against the massive forces of reaction that are going to be working against him, and also whether he'll be able to maintain the unity of his the deputies, the Moreno deputies in Mexico's National Assembly, and so that he'll be able to get through his legislative program. All that remains to be seen. But and the symbolic importance of somebody who came to power on that agenda, an agenda that was specifically and explicitly in favor of meeting the needs and aspirations of ordinary people in Mexico, that goes completely against the current neoliberal ideology that dominates the G20. I mean, if you look at the G20, the G20 are a bunch of countries, but the 20th is the European Union that is a member as itself, and there are also European countries like Spain, I think, is a member, France, Germany, the United Kingdom. And what have those countries done in Europe? I mean, you just have to look at Greece. Look what they've crucified Greece. The policies that they promote in the European Union are policies of austerity and essentially extremely repressive policies, not just in economic terms, but also in social terms. It's people forget that there's been a state of siege in France for over a year.
Yep.
Right? And people forget that because the European Union pipes up at the every opportunity talking about democracy and liberty and all that stuff.
Yeah, right.
And one of its leading members, France, had a state of siege for over a year.
That's amazing.
So, you know, when are they going to give us a break from all this democracy and freedom nonsense? Well, anyway, so going into the G20, it's no surprise at all that Mauricio Macri, who is somebody that's characterized by kind of an infatuation, a totally irrational infatuation with the kind of the policies that come out of Europe and out of North America that have nothing to do, that they're the direct opposite of what Andrés Manuel López Obrador stands for, at least at the moment, he stands for, and which is meeting people, the needs of ordinary people, and focusing on the needs of the human person. And that is absolutely fundamental in terms of you know, if there's a dividing line between the progressive governments in Latin America and governments that aren't progressive, reactionary right-wing governments, the dividing line is, are their policies focused on the needs of the human person, or are their policies focused on the corporate profit?
Right.
And that's, you know, that's an absolutely fundamental division. Of course,
right.
There are several others, but that's one of the fundamental ones.
That's the fundamental one, really.
And so the what have you got at the G20? You've got a bunch of countries coming from a position like Mauricio Macri, where they argue, and this is something that you've commented on several times. They argue that the economic success will come from free market policies and promoting the corporate investment and so on and so on. But their policies have completely failed in practice, wherever you look. Now, you've corrected me quite rightly in the past, where you say, well, of course those policies haven't failed, because they're not designed to work.
Right.
And so in one sense, I'm right in that these policies have failed for what they're ostensibly supposed to do.
They fail the people. They fail the society.
That was meant to happen.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
As you point out.
Right.
So and the person, I think you're more right than I am.
Well, no, it's like this. I leave the house to run down to the corner deli to buy cigarettes or whatever, and then come back. And when I come back, my wife asks me, were you successful? Well, I got robbed. I got banged in the head. That's why it took me 2 hours. I passed out. They stole my wallet. They found the car keys. They stole the car. And they have my wallet so they can come back here and rob everything. So I failed, but they were successful.
Right.
That's how it works.
So, yeah. Right. So, that's not a bad analogy for the G20. You've got these looters and robbers,
right,
congregating in Buenos Aires from North America and Europe,
yep,
and they're meeting up with countries like Russia and China, and whatever you think about the Russia's ideology, if it has one, and it's certainly in the case of China, you're talking about a country that is focused on the needs of people.
Yep.
There's no argument about that. I mean, they've lived. Western economists often say, have said over recent years, oh, look how good globalization is. It's lifted all these people out of poverty. Well, the great majority of them have been lifted out of poverty by Chinese, in China,
right,
because
right.
of China's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
And it's got nothing to do with globalization. It's got to do with China's domestic policy being focused on the needs of its people.
Right.
So
that's right.
All these arguments are going to turn up in the G20 meeting, but they'll very likely be suppressed. But the underlying currents, the important underlying currents in the G20? Well, the most obvious one, of course, is the role precisely of China. Its infrastructure investment, its technology exchange, the way that it relates to people, and there's a genuine exchange of technology. I mean, just look at the exchange of technology that's taken place in Venezuela, where Venezuelans now operate their satellites. I think they've got 3 satellites,
yep,
that were built and launched by China. But it's Venezuelans that are operating them. Why? Because China trained them. So you've got that kind of exchange of technology, infrastructure investment that we talked about so many times in recent conversations, in particular the transcontinental railroad from the Peru's Pacific coast across to Brazil's southern Atlantic coast.
Right.
And you've got the trade openness, China's commitment to trading, which, you know, I'm I'm sure that there are all kinds of arguments about, you know, who benefits more, but because China exports and tends to import raw materials. But one of the things that people can expect from increasing Chinese investment over the next few years is that Latin America's continuing dependence on export of raw materials, in the case of Argentina, so in Brazil, for example, soy and beef, in the case of Chile and Bolivia and Peru, minerals, in the case of Venezuela and Colombia, hydrocarbons, oil and gas, and Latin America can expect a result of Chinese influence and their growing exchange with China, their dependence on that raw material exports will progressively diminish as they get the benefit of technology exchange from China, as we've seen in Venezuela.
As they build capital too, you know, that's one of the things too. Like the idea of win-win is that you don't leave the other side impoverished, but rather enriched.
Yeah, and that's happening in Africa too.
Yep.
So, and you contrast that with the kind of what I call the do what we want or else diplomacy of the United States, the kind of gangster diplomacy of the United States.
Yep.
Now, and if you take Nicaragua's case or Central America in general, if you look at what does the United States do to benefit those countries' economies? Well, very little. I mean, the main programs that it has that are genuinely beneficial to those economies have to do with agricultural extension, improving seed technology, and that kind of thing. Well, look at the United States. It's a country of 300 million people. Look at how powerful it is and what it could do in terms of transforming infrastructure and so forth, like China does. But it doesn't. And if you look at the United States development assistance programs, they're like Taiwan. Taiwan does that. Taiwan does seed technology and that kind of agricultural extension stuff. So for the fact that is the main benefit that Central American countries get from United States technical cooperation for development is pathetic. You know, it really, there's no other word for it.
Yep.
And then the rest of U.S. Development cooperation is interventionist. Yep. You know, democracy programs and co-opting judicial and criminal justice systems. That's what the rest of United States government cooperation funding does.
That's right.
So you've got, on the one hand, you've got China coming up with multi-billion dollar in infrastructure investment, win-win trade proposals, technology exchange that enables countries like Venezuela to operate its own satellites and so forth. Right. And then on the other hand, you've got the United States saying, well, we can improve a few seeds for you, you know, and it's just pathetic. And what do United States diplomats think? Do they think that people can't see that? Do they think that people in Latin America, you know, are totally stupid and don't understand that? Of course they understand it.
Yeah, right.
And that's why, from the United States point of view, it's so important for them to co-opt judicial systems, because so as to lock up and make it impossible for progressive politicians to run for office like they've done to Lula, like they're trying to do to Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, like they're trying to do to Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and so on. So the political options for the United States and their allies, although they're in the ascendant at the moment, their political options are narrowing all the time. The window is closing for them. as China increases its influence, and as the G20 neoliberal policies fail on their own terms in Latin America and elsewhere,
right,
also get challenged by China and Russia in particular.
Well, there was an indigenous challenge in Argentina to this also this year. You had last week, on the 20th, I think it was last Tuesday, it started, in Buenos Aires, in Caballito. There was organized by Cristina de Kirchner and Dilma Rousseff, the first World Critical Thinking Forum.
Right.
And they had all of the, you know, the folks that, Mujica, a whole bunch of folks were there, Bolivia's vice president, there was the guy from Monedero from Podemos, former right. Colombian president Ernesto Samper, and a bunch of others, and you know they're basically organizing an international shadow counter response. In other words, you point out before there's one of two paths that get followed by these governments and the institutions that spawn and support them. One is to serve the needs of the people. The other is to serve the needs of a very small elite. The G20 generally has historically served the elite. There's a response coming from the grassroots, basically. And I'm hoping we're going to see that develop further over the next few years, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I'm optimistic that we'll see that develop, despite U.S. attempts to derail normal political processes in Latin America and the Caribbean. I mean, one interesting thing you touched on there is the changing role of Brazil and Argentina over the last few years. Because if you look at what Lula da Silva did and Dilma Rousseff did in Brazil, and what the Kirchners, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her now deceased husband Nestor, what they did for Brazil and Argentina was project those nations onto the world stage as progressive forces, proactive forces, forces that are trying to meet the needs of their people, but at the same time understanding that they could only do that by changing the international structures in which those nations are forced to operate, and kind of cut themselves out of the straitjacket that had been imposed by the dominance of the United States and its allies like Japan and the European Union. That, for example, and one of the things that happened in between 2006 and 2010, 2011, was the opening up of the IMF and the paradoxical situation in which you had, as a direct result of the global financial crisis provoked by the collapse of United States and European financial capitalism, and their inability to keep their kind of bubble economy under control through 2007, 2008, 2009, and that led to the United States. I think it was in fact George Bush that called the first recent, the resurgence of the G20 rather than the G7. And when was it that the G20 took over the G7? I think it was towards the end of the George Bush presidency. When was that? Around 2008. So I think that's right. And so at the time of that was the kind of what they were trying to do was kind of spread the blame or spread the burden of their failure onto the G20 because their system failed to do what they said it would do, and so they kind of spread the blame onto a bunch of other countries.
Well, next year is 20 years because it was the G20 was founded in 1999.
Right.
So there's that on the waning years of Clinton.
But I don't think it really, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but as I remember, it really came to the fore around the 2008 crisis. And that was, paradoxically, that was when the IMF came, they kind of revived it. It was it had been a zombie. Yeah. In the years up until 2008, and I think they capitalized it with what was it, 500, however many million dollars it was, and they capitalized the IMF again, and the IMF began to play a key role in the neoliberal, in inverted commas, recovery from the 2008 crisis. Yeah. Because, and as far as I can see, we're still suffering the effects of that crisis. And so you've got this changed role of Brazil and Argentina. Back then, Brazil and Argentina were saying, well, look, we can do all these different things to kind of mitigate the crisis and do better. And they were very much arguing against the flow. They were against the current of opinion in the G20, obviously. But at least they were there playing that role. And then with the departure of Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff and the assumption of power in Brazil by the usurper government of Michel Temer, and with the election of Mauricio Macri in Argentina in 2015 on a totally fraudulent electoral program, very similar to Lenin Moreno in Ecuador. The Brazil and Argentina, kind of their roles flipped, and they became, instead of kind of making all kinds of proposals and being proactive about, you know, these are things we can do to mitigate the crisis and defend people's basic, address the basic people's basic needs, and instead of that, you now have two governments under Temer. It's going to be worse under Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
Under Temer and Macri, who just string along with whatever they're told by their corporate masters in North America and Europe. And that's another thing that's somewhat awkward for Latin America in terms of this G20 meeting. The fact that the Brazilian president representing that very important country, not just in Latin America, but in at a world level, will be somebody who's on their way out.
Yeah.
And Bolsonaro, I think he was invited by Macri, but chose not to go. And there's an indication that Bolsonaro, and one of the things that China will be arguing for at this G20 is, against protectionism. It'll be trying to make the case to sustain the kind of open trading philosophy that has served it so well in recent years against the protectionism of Donald Trump and his administration. But it looks as though Bolsonaro is on Trump's side.
Yeah.
So another keynote thing that's going to be influencing the development of the Congress will be the fact that while Russia and China are working together in an increasingly consolidated way to consolidate their economic plans for Eurasia, their neighbors are finding extremely convincing, much more convincing than the kinds of proposals that are coming out of the United States, for example. While Russia and China are building that very, very strong consolidated Eurasian bloc, you've got the United States squabbling and bickering with the European Union over whether or not to, you know, the European Union's trying to maintain relations with Iran at a time when the United States is trying to impose yet more sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy behavior coming out. But one of the things also, we're coming down to like 3-4 minutes left. One of the things that supposedly is on a fast track for some settlement is the trade dispute between the U.S. and China. I was watching some of the, you know, the backstory stuff today on reading some things and listening to some of the people inside the administration that were, you know, had cameras pointed at them. They're like, well, we're either going to settle this or we're going to settle it. In other words, it's either going to be, you know, fixed or, you know, game on. So coming out next week, the posture of the U.S. vis-a-vis China and vice versa probably will be known to most people, for at least for the short or medium term. And a lot of the other things then, you know, they're going to shake out. They'll have an opportunity to shake out around that, including the relationship of, say, Brazil as one of the BRICS members to the BRICS group. And, you know, and Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, you know, all these, like Mexico being in flux, as you mentioned before, we have a big changeover coming, you know, the day this opens next Friday, this Friday. So, you know, a lot of balls up in the air, and some of them are going to start hitting the ground soon.
And something else to note is that it seems to me that the United States is very much on the defensive diplomatically, because if you look at the program of President Xi, and he's before he goes to the G20, I'm not sure, I think he's visiting Spain and Portugal first. And he's also going to visit Panama, which has broken off with Taiwan in favor of opening diplomatic relations with China. So right. President Xi will be visiting two important members of the European Union. He'll be visiting a country that's supposedly an ally of the United States, but has opted to dump Taiwan in favor of China. Right. And then he'll be going to Argentina for the G20, but I think he's also planning to be at the presidential inauguration on December 1st of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. That's actually quite interesting. 20 heads of state will be participating in that, whereas only 3 heads of state turned up to the Ibero-American summit a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So I think it's really significant that Mexico, although it's not going to be represented at the highest level of the G20, it's going to be a very important player there, but in its absence.
All we can do is wait, watch, and see. So we're going to do that, and we appreciate your time. All right, Tony, thank you for your time. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome, John. Look forward to talking to you next week.
Same. Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's Ukraine versus Russia again. A minor maritime incident on the Kerch Strait is said to be anything between a major international crisis to a cheap campaign trick as Ukraine enters an election cycle. Take your pick. But one thing is for sure, Russia is deemed aggressive by the West even when defending its sovereignty. Crosstalking strained relations. I'm joined by my guest, Adriel Consanta in London. He's a foreign affairs consultant and analyst. We also have in London, Mary Dashefsky. She is a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. And in Washington, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former senior security policy analyst in the office of the Secretary of Defense. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Mary, let me go to you first here. I obviously read up. I'm prepared for this program. I looked at all Western media and government reactions. And I have foreign policy, an article that came out on the 27th. And the title is Putin Pushes Russia-Ukraine Tensions to a Four-Year High. Now, the reason why I mention that, and I think I'll quote something of it later, is that there's assumption that they can assume what Russia's intentions are always, no matter what the topic. But in this instance, there's very little attention given to what Ukraine actually did. And then Russia's reaction to those actions here. Again, we have these diametrical, different narratives in play here. One of demonization and one is a wronged party, when it's far more complex than that and far more dangerous than that. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I have to say that I was very surprised to wake up to discover that there'd been this clash of navies, essentially, in the Straits of Kerch, and that Russia and Ukraine seemed to be on the verge of a maritime war. And it all seemed incredibly dangerous. And Ukraine had managed very successfully, I think, to get its version of the story out first. So their version, which, I mean, it hasn't essentially been disproved, was that there were two gunboats and a tug, and that a Russian ship crashed into the tugboat deliberately. And there are the crews of the two gunboats have been taken prisoner and are now in what is Russian annexed Crimea. So I think those facts are there, but the question of why this
not,
happened,
but Mary, they're not
was
even
not addressed.
But those are not even the facts. Okay, first of all, if you look at the footage, the tugboat was desperate to be hit by the Russian ship. I mean, it was zigging and zagging, and if you understand Russian well enough, you couldn't repeat those words in English because they were saying basically, "Get out of the way." All right. Okay, let me go to Michael here, Michael. This all happened on Sunday, but on Saturday and the Friday before and the week before and the month before, ships were going under that bridge into that sea unimpeded. Why? You got to call up and say, hey, we're coming through. This is our type of boat. This is the type of time. This is what we're carrying. And do you have a pilot there that can escort us? That's protocol. That they'd been doing that for years, but not on Sunday. And Ukraine didn't put that story out. It didn't notify the proper authorities here. That story, the Ukrainians forgot to give out. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, it's subject to the protocols back in 2003. And up until that point, they were abiding by it for the most part. But the problem is in a larger strategic picture, what you're seeing here is the West looking for an excuse to go after Moscow. Secondly, you're also seeing that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, is in serious political trouble.
Serious trouble.
And I smell a tail wagging the dog here, reminiscent of Saakashvili back in Georgia in 2008 when he provoked the Russians and shot Russian peacekeepers in South Ossetia, and then the war was on. At that time, it was to try and get NATO to protect Georgia. In this case, I think by declaring martial law, as Poroshenko did, he's trying to solidify his political base, if he can.
Solidify.
I doubt that he will.
8% solidify. Adriel, let me go to you in London. Let me give this little tidbit out to everybody. When Yanukovych was illegally ejected from the presidency in February 2014, his public opinion approval was 24%. Poroshenko, by even Ukrainian accounts, is 8%. So I wonder what's really in play here. I don't know what the intentions were on the Kerch Strait, but I can see political maneuvering on the part of Poroshenko and the people that put him in power. Go ahead in London.
Thank you, Peter. As you rightly pointed out, it is the fact that on 30th of March 2019, we should see the elections coming in the Ukraine. But the current president of Ukraine, Mr. Poroshenko, just did what he did. So what he did is that he violated, I mean, the Ukraine violated the Article 19th and 21st of the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, and it was a provocation, as everyone is saying this. But what was the purpose of this of this provocation? Is internally to curb any sort of gatherings or protests in Ukraine, to regulate the media, as you rightly pointed out, Mr. Poroshenko. As we are estimating today, his chances to get to the second round of the presidential elections in Ukraine is Zero. He's not even able to get to the second round. What Mr. Poroshenko is doing is he's waiting for the contestation from the US. He's waiting to be acknowledged as the rightful holder of the power in the Ukraine, and also the facilitator for the US neocons to use the Ukraine for the base to attack Russia in the future. I mean, let us be clear. Yesterday, my professor from the University of Warsaw, Professor Stanisław Bieleń, contacted me at night saying that what they are doing, asking me what they are doing. Well, I mean, when we are sitting in Moscow, in Washington, or in London, it looks like, it's another conflict. No, you know that on the border between Ukraine and Poland, there are protests and people are fighting with each other.
Okay, hang on. Let me go to Mary here. You know, Mary, with this proclamation of martial law, all of us here on this program and many of our viewers have been following what's been going on in Ukraine. So this is the first crisis situation Ukraine is faced to declare martial law. That is quite amazing here. And of course, with the impending election cycle, the shutting down of public discourse, controlling the media here. Where's the outrage about that in Western media and from the U.S. State Department and everybody else that was quick to blame, interpret Russia's intentions? Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I think that the declaration of martial law was certainly seen as a quite drastic move, which seemed completely out of proportion to the clash that there had been in the Straits of Kerch. But I think that something quite interesting has happened that may reflect some of the difficulties that maybe some of Ukraine's Western sponsors had with the whole concept of declaring martial law so close to an election. And this was that when the proposal came before Parliament in Ukraine, as I understand it, it's actually been reduced quite significantly.
Yeah.
So while the initial idea was that the whole of Ukraine would be subject to martial law with all the restrictions on freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, presumably election campaigning and all that, the provision that has actually passed through the Parliament is for something rather less than that. I think it only goes up to the 27th of December, so
yep,
a couple of months before the election. It's also restricted to the border areas of Ukraine. So to that extent, it can be seen, or at least it can be justified by Ukraine, as a security measure. And I just get the impression, and this may be totally wrong, that between President Poroshenko saying he was proposing martial law and Parliament actually discussing it, there may have been some rather urgent advice transmitted through certain Western embassies to say, well, maybe this actually doesn't look very good. Maybe you had better think of it rather, maybe limit it a bit in terms of the time and in terms of the geography. And I think that's what seems to have happened.
Okay, Michael, I could tell you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, what hasn't been mentioned yet is that under that martial law edict, he can actually postpone elections if he so chooses. So this gives him unusual presidential authority in which he can continue on and can extend the martial law provisions indefinitely if he chooses to do so. So this is not, this is almost an open-ended problem.
Of course it is.
That the West is not addressing.
Well, Ukraine on Sunday broke a number of provisions of international law when it comes to the seas.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, do we have a lot of confidence that they're going to keep their word after passing this law through Parliament? I got to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. After that break, we'll continue our discussion on strained relations. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Michael Maloof in Washington. I had to cut you off. We had to go to a hard break. Finish up, my friend.
Yeah, one thing that's not being mentioned all that much in Western media is the fact that for months leading up to this episode, Ukrainian ships were also detaining Russian ships in that very same area. And it's been going back and forth because of the protocols and the challenges that are required. So this is not just a one-sided thing. This morning there was an interview of the captain of the Ukrainian ships who basically said, we were asked to provide information on what our intentions were, and my orders from higher authority was, don't respond. So it looks like it was a planned provocation.
Well, I think it's quite clear to anyone that wants to look at the facts here. Adriel, you already mentioned NATO here. NATO popped up immediately to talking about Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, number one, okay? And it should be made clear here. And also, this seems to be a provocation on a larger scale to have Ukraine become a member of NATO, which, you know, it's kind of like forcing it through here. But this is very ill-founded logic, because as we saw on Sunday, there are tensions between Russia and Ukraine for a variety of reasons. Why would NATO want to have a member within their alliance that has bad relations with a neighbor that could come to a military exchange? What is the logic? I thought NATO was about projecting peace and stability. It seems to me they're doing just the opposite. Go ahead in London.
Well, NATO is wanting to have a Ukraine as a member in order to use Eastern Europeans as a cannon fodder. They know that Ukrainian current situation in Ukraine, led by the Nazis, because let us be clear, all the Jewish newspapers and all the media and all the researchers know that the neo-Nazism in Ukraine is doing very well. So the main cause and main thing to have Ukraine as a close ally is to use it as a stick to poke the Russian bear. And also, from the geopolitical point of view, let us not forget Mr. McIntyre, who clearly written in his Democratic Ideals and Reality book that who rules East Europe commands the heartland, who rules the heartland commands the world island, who rules the world island commands the world. So let us not be deceived by the newspapers, like, for instance, The Guardian. Mr. Simon Jenkins has written all of a sudden, straight after the information coming out that the Ukrainian soldiers or sailors has been captured, that forget about Brexit. The war in Ukraine is the greatest threat for Europe. So let us be fair, that the machinery, the PR machinery behind this is coming from the English sphere. I mean, it is beyond the comprehension. I mean, fragile situation.
It's just the opposite. It's very comprehensive to me, because it all seems to fit together. I mean, like, it's like an oiled machine. It really kicked in. Mary, of course, there's been talk, this is one of the first reactions to all of this, is that this is also aimed at the Trump administration. You know, the Trump administration has sanctioned Russia over and over again. Congress has more sanctions on the way for the Skripal affair that the U.S. has nothing to do with. But anyway, and then we have the G20. I mean, so make sure Trump and Putin don't talk here. I mean, I think that's a bit of a stretch, but because I think the U.S.-Russia relations have been so soured, it'll take a generation for that to change. And I can tell you, most people on my side of the pond have just given up on good relations, just have to grin and bear getting through what we are now. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, well, I mean, the question of the G20 and the probable meeting of President Trump and President Putin in Argentina in the framework of that meeting, that has certainly been mentioned as a consideration maybe for the timing of this clash in the Kerch Straits. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but in a way, if it was designed to derail such a meeting and to prevent any sort of agreement, it's probably only half succeeded, because in a way, new tension between Russia and Ukraine actually provides a better reason for the two of them to talk. So, I mean, I'm not completely convinced that it would actually frustrate that sort of meeting. But I think there's something else that maybe we've neglected in all of this, which is that when you look at the map of the Sea of Azov and where this incident happened, this is an accident waiting to happen.
Yep.
It is an absolute nightmare of geography. And when you actually consider, you know, I think what was forgotten when this clash was first reported, nobody has mentioned, I think, the fact that there was actually a clash way back in 2003, almost in the very same place.
Yep.
And the fact that there is a navigation agreement for the Sea of Azov dates from that clash. That was the outcome of that clash, that it was agreed that there should be shared navigation between Russia and Ukraine through the Sea of Azov, and there were regulations put in place. And in a way, it's almost more remarkable that this is the first serious incident since 2003 than anything else. I mean, for 15 years, those regulations, which were put in place on an emergency basis, have actually held.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. Let me go to Michael here. Mary brings up an excellent point, but then that goes, we go right back to the beginning. It was a mechanism that did work. It was working up until Saturday.
Right.
And then there was an intention to break that understanding here. And we have to remember there's a $3.2 billion bridge there now, which is of a great strategic importance to Russia. They have to use extra assets to protect it. And we've heard Ukrainian politicians and others that say it's a legitimate target for destruction, an act of terror. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I don't believe in coincidences at all. The fact that there is going to be the G20, and this indicates that Poroshenko was leading up to that, pretty much like what we saw, as I refer back again to 2008 with the Georgian incident, in which Saakashvili was warned repeatedly, don't antagonize Russia, which he was planning to do. This is what's happening again, and now it's drawn in as a result, the big boys. And what's interesting is that Trump himself has been rather silent on all this. So I think that he is sending a signal, really, that he intends to cool it down a little bit. He's going to have that meeting, and things are going to work out. I think he's looking forward to that meeting with Putin. And he still has desire to work with Putin on a myriad of issues. But this clearly was a calculation on the part of Poroshenko and people close to him. And people within the deep state, particularly the State Department and the neocons, that antagonize these guys, because their relationship with the Poroshenko government is very, very strong. And so the amount of instigation there is incredible to incite. And I think that that's what we have here in preparation for this meeting, in order to get Trump basically to say, I'm not going to talk to Putin. But I don't think that that's what Trump wants to do.
Yeah, well,
I think he wants to meet with Putin.
I think he's.
And I think that it's going to be an important meeting.
I think it's interesting is that he preferred to blast Theresa May over Brexit than to tweet about Ukraine. I thought that was interesting. Jeez, Theresa May can't win for losing these days.
It's not high on his priority.
It's not high. Let me go back to Adriel in London here. It's speaking of the Sea of Azov. You know, I read that the Atlantic Council is proposing, members of the Atlantic Council, that this should be militarized, that, you know, NATO should go in there. It's a shallow sea. NATO ships can't even navigate it. Maybe some tugs, but it's like 7 meters deep.
What are you going to do? What kind of ship do you want to put in there? I mean, I guess if they want to do that, then why shouldn't Russia be able to put its ships into Lake Michigan? That's fair, wouldn't you say? Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, we can see a difference, you know, between the behavior of Russia and America. I think that any other country than Russia, if they would be attacked and provocated, you know, constantly by so many Western powers, we would already have a nuclear holocaust in this planet. But I'm full of, you know, praise for President Putin and for his administration that they, you know, still keep, you know, the nerves on the ground. I mean, you know, they are not willing to participate in this, you know, tit for tat foreign policy movements.
This is a textbook study in patience, in strategic patience. You know, Mary, you know, I said in my introduction, you know, Russia is demonized and called aggressive when it defends its own sovereignty. I think, you know, that's something the foreign policy blob, where Michael is right now, they can never come to that conclusion. They never can reflect upon that Russia will do everything it can to protect its sovereignty, and it's demonized for it. Last word goes to you, Mary.
Yes, well, I mean, I think there's an awful lot of misreading of Russia's position on pretty much everything.
Pretty much.
With the assumption that Russia is aggressive rather than defensive, and the motives are misread because of that. But I also think that Michael and Adrian are both absolutely right when they say that both Trump and Putin have really kept out of this latest clash, or whatever they said has been very low key and designed to tone things down. And I think that means that whatever, hopefully, absolutely. But I think that means that whatever the rights and wrongs of may have happened, the two big players in this are at the moment determined that it shouldn't escalate into that sort of much bigger
game. Let's keep our fingers crossed. That's a semi-optimistic note here. That's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests in London and in Washington. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk News.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.